From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, a lawsuit accuses two federal agencies of coordinating meetings with immigrants to arrest and, in some cases, deport them. Also, checking some of the claims made by candidates in the 7th Congressional District race, such as Ayanna Pressley.
I worked for some 4 years to reform our state's liquor license laws.
And Congressman Michael Capuano on the Fairmont line.
We've now increased it by 6 stops. We've got better trains on the system.
Also, our team in Central America traveling with a congressional fact-finding mission.
We're not going to get the truth from the U.S. Embassy. And we're certainly not going to get the truth from the Trump State Department.
Plus, why is it taking so long for recreational marijuana to come to Massachusetts?
From day one, we've been very consistent saying we're going to do this right, and that's more important than any particular date.
That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Two federal agencies are accused of setting up traps to arrest and sometimes deport undocumented immigrants in Boston. The American Civil Liberties Union has filed suit alleging that the agencies worked together to set up meetings with undocumented residents who would then be arrested. Yesterday, the ACLU filed documents saying that it has discovered that Immigration and Customs Enforcement and U.S. Customs and Immigration Services brought spouses of American citizens in for interviews to prove that their marriages were legitimate, and then they arrested them at those interviews. Joining us to talk about this is WBUR's Fred Tice. Hi there, Fred.
Hi, Deb.
So tell us about this lawsuit.
So the suit alleges that ICE coordinated with USCIS so that when people came in for their interviews with USCIS about seeking legal residency, they'd be arrested by the ICE agents. Many of those going to USCIS were the spouses of American citizens, and they were seeking legal status because they were married to Americans. The lawsuit contains some pretty startling emails. One, for example, from an ICE agent advising CIS not to schedule the interviews at the same time so as to avoid a lot of attention. Let me read from that email. As far as scheduling goes, the email says, I'd prefer not to do them all at one time, as it's not only a strain on our ability to transport and process several arrests at once, but it also has the potential to be a trigger for negative media interests, as we've seen in the past. If you have the ability to schedule one or two at a time and spread them apart, that would work best for us.
Negative media interests. Hmm. So basically, this suit says that these interviews with government agencies were essentially a setup.
Yes. The ACLU attorney Adriana LaFay told WBUR this morning that USCIS manipulated what is essentially a legal path to citizenship.
They considered the enforcement needs of ICE. They considered the need to avoid negative press. They never considered the fact that our clients had a process that they were following.
And the suit is asking a federal judge, Mark Wolf, to order ICE not to arrest or detain any of their clients as they seek permanent residency.
And so what about these federal agencies, Fred? What were the Department of Homeland Security, which oversees them, what are they saying about this suit?
Well, they refuse to comment because they say they're not going to comment on pending litigation.
Now, you started covering this back in April, and there's a lot going on here within these offices, within these departments, personnel-wise and otherwise, in terms of this decision-making and in terms of what's being done here. So let's start with a story that you did back in April about Lillian Calderon. Can you remind us of that?
Sure. So this is when the ACLU first filed this lawsuit. Lillian Calderon is among the spouses who had been taken into custody. She had lived in the U.S. She has lived in the U.S. since she was 3 years old. She has two American children who are 2 and 4. And when she showed up in Providence in January for her interview to get legal residence based on her marriage to an American, ICE agents detained her and took her to the Suffolk County House of Corrections here in Boston. At a press conference last spring, she talked about the arrest and became emotional about not being able to talk to one of her children before being detained.
I just wanted to speak to him. I wanted to say bye to him because they didn't even give me a chance to say bye to him.
And, you know, it's important to note that Mark Wolf, the federal judge, has already found that ICE and USCIS were breaking the law by keeping the husbands and wives of Americans in detention for extended periods of time, we're talking months, without giving their attorneys notice that they were being detained. It's not clear whether it's illegal for ICE to arrest people at their marriage interviews. That's what needs to be determined, right?
Right, right.
But this spring, the outgoing and incoming heads of ICE in Boston told the court that they would target people who posed a danger to the community. So they were going to, they had changed the policy. They were going to continue changing that policy. And they were not targeting people to become who were trying to become permanent residents because they married Americans. But after making that promise, the supposedly incoming head of ICE in Boston was removed from that job and replaced with an interim head. And she told the court that no one is exempt from arrests. It's really not clear what's going to happen now because she's due to leave on Friday. She's just an interim head. And then the man who, you know, was supposed to come in June and had promised that he was only going to arrest people who were a danger to the community, he is taking over finally. And so we're just going to have to wait and see what happens.
Hmm. So basically a lot of confusion. And again, I'm sure there are folks who are listening who are thinking, well, you know, they're not in the country legally, right? ICE has the authority to do whatever it wants.
That's correct. But there's a process, particularly when you marry an American, to, you know, right, to basically normalize your situation and start yourself on the path to legal residence.
Hmm. So what happens from here, Fred? We know the government's moved to dismiss this suit. We've got, you know, new personnel in the office here. What happens legally in terms of this lawsuit and in terms of what might be going on in the ICE office in Boston?
There will be more hearings. There'll be a hearing. The next hearing is on Monday. Judge Mark Wolf has scheduled a hearing for Monday.
All right. WBUR's Fred Tice. He reports on politics and higher education. Fred, thanks so much for being with us.
Well, you're welcome, Deb.
Three weeks from today, Democratic primary voters go to the polls in the 7th Congressional District for what some say is a race for the soul of the Democratic Party. Voters will choose between incumbent Congressman Michael Capuano or his challenger, Boston City Councilor Ayanna Pressley. The two candidates have met face-to-face twice so far during this campaign, including right here on Radio Boston last week for a debate. Each time, the focus of the candidates has turned to leadership style and perspective and experience and not so much on policy differences. But both candidates have highlighted what they consider some of their major accomplishments as politicians. So today we want to take a closer look at one accomplishment from each candidate. For Pressley, she says it's liquor license reform and equity in Boston. For Congressman Capuano, he cites improvements to the Fairmount commuter rail line. Well, joining us to take this closer look at the candidates' records is Megan Irons. She's a Boston Globe social justice and race reporter. Megan, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much for having me. It's nice to be here.
Nice to have you. So let's start with liquor license reform. This was from Boston City Councilor Ayanna Pressley, and she highlighted her work during last week's WBUR Boston Globe UMass Boston debate. Let's listen to a little bit of what she said.
I worked for some 4 years to reform our state's liquor license laws, working with the city council, two mayors, and our state legislature to disrupt what was a two-tiered food system, resulting in a density of walkable amenities in restaurants in neighborhoods like the North End, the Back Bay, and the South End, and neighborhoods like Roxbury, Mattapan, and Dorchester and Hyde Park, which did not have new restaurants for 10, 15, 20 years.
So, Megan, just very briefly, because I know this is a long storied history here, but briefly, this history of liquor license reform. What happened here in terms of Ayanna Pressley's history with it?
So Ayanna Pressley has been a champion in terms of leading this effort on liquor license reform. She was there from the beginning, successfully getting liquor license reform in the state. And what this law did was to give Boston the authority to give out 75 additional licenses over a 3-year period. And the goal here was to revive the business districts in neighborhoods that have been that are not like Back Bay or the North End or downtown. These are neighborhoods that are struggling for some sort of economic vitality. And she argued, along with the mayor and along with other people, successfully that these neighborhoods could benefit from restaurants that brought in people and their families, not only for dinner, but for a cocktail or two. And so this law came about in 2014. It had very, very good intentions for the Main Street and business districts. It wanted to chip away the unfairness in how the liquor licenses had been traditionally doled out. Mostly it's to big business owners. It is to big restaurants and to people with deep pockets. And many people who did not have access to a liquor license were often left out of this thriving industry.
So basically, Councillor Presley had all the best intentions here to try to sort of spread the wealth, if you will, among some of the more underserved communities to make sure that they also got liquor licenses. And what ended up happening was the licenses actually went to the big players and right. didn't actually do what was intended. Is that right?
In fact, yes, you're totally right. In fact, it created this unintentional problem. Okay, it created uneven competition. It left out certain neighborhoods. It allowed businesses that were already established to get the licenses. The licenses were intended to be easily attainable. You just have to show where you're going to operate. You have to provide a lease and pay $3,000. In the past, in the unregulated market, the licenses were costing upwards of $300,000. But it turned out that only people with establishments and only people with money, restaurant owners that is, were able to afford them. And so there were some business movement in Roxbury. Not one in Mattapan, not one applicant in Mattapan.
But it was $3,000. This is what Councillor Presley put into effect, that it would lower the cost to $3,000, and these folks were supposed to have access.
Right. $3,000 would be accessible, the thinking was. I mean, I want to say also that the city and the mayor really pushed this effort as well. Councillor Presley was a driver, of course. But yes, the idea was that it was accessible in terms of cost and affordable in terms of cost. But it did leave out a lot of people. Now, last year, the city, along with Presley, pressed to get an additional 150 or so licenses, nothing. There's no action on that as yet.
Okay, so let's move on to Congressman Capuano and the Fairmont Commuter Rail Line. This is the only commuter rail route that goes entirely within Boston, serving Mattapan, Hyde Park, Dorchester. And he says in his 10 terms as congressman, he's championed a number of transit projects. So during our debate last week with Congressman Capuano and Ayanna Presley, Capuano defended his work. Let's listen to a little bit of that.
The Fairmont Line was a long-term investment, working with Governor Patrick at the time, because if people remember, there were only a few stops that were almost never used. We've now increased it by 6 stops. We've got better trains on the system. And let's not forget that the people running the commuter rail were taking trains out of service on this line to give to other lines. That has stopped.
So, Megan, I'm just wondering, in terms of this is a major accomplishment of Congressman Capuano, take us back to why he would cite this as such a big deal.
Well, for the people who are living in parts of Mattapan, Dorchester, Hyde Park, and Roxbury, they've been completely cut out of rapid rail service from their homes to their jobs downtown. And for years, many of these people have been living with a rail line behind their yards and had seen freight trains running behind their yards and a little used commuter rail line, the Fairmont Line. And a lot of effort and years of work went into getting the state to fix up this line to make it accessible for the people who needed fast services to downtown. And the activists from across that particular area of the city would tell you that Michael Capuano had been instrumental in securing federal funding to get the line not just sporadically operating, but a fully functional line. The Fairmont commuter rail line is unique in that it's the only commuter rail line that operates totally in Boston. Most people would think of commuter rails as going out to the suburb, but this one operates entirely in Boston. There are problems with issues with pricing. It was too expensive, some people thought. And some people also thought that the state didn't do a very good job in terms of marketing this line. And Capiona has been in that fight. The activists say they needed someone who would be out there pushing this issue for them. There's so much hope on this line. And it struggled with ridership. And when that happened, I believe it was last year, Capuano gave $53,000 of his campaign money to pay for tickets so that people could take the line. It could increase ridership. And indeed, ridership did go up 55% after that first week, I think, and it has tripled since 2012. However, there's still problems with increasing ridership. The ridership on that particular line lags the other lines in the system. And so there's been a big effort from the activists to get the T to do things like allowing passengers to use their Charlie card on that line. This is a line that is trying, it's a commuter rail, but it's trying to be a subway. And it's trying to do a lot of things. There is also hope along the line that there would be development that would bloom as a result of the expansion and renovation of this line. However, residents are very concerned that whatever is erected around those stations, that it would also be detrimental to the renters.
They're worried about gentrification, right?
Yeah, worried about gentrification and all that and that kind of stuff.
So it sounds like both of these accomplishments that both politicians are citing may have started with good intentions, but didn't necessarily work out as planned. Why do you think they're touting them as major accomplishments here? Is it because it's something very tangible that a lot of people can understand and look to, or is it touching on some broader theme here? You know, many folks, as we said in the beginning, have called this a race for the soul of the Democratic Party. Is that overstating it, or is this sort of what's going on?
No. I think, you know, listen, getting that rail line up and running is a major thing. It's a major thing for people who had to take three different buses to get to their jobs. Getting liquor license is a major thing, even though they didn't count on the fact that it would take a lot more for people who don't have the infrastructure or the asset or the money to come up with the $3,000 and don't, you know, and find a building and find a place to open a restaurant. So these are indeed major issues, even though they're not fully formed. You know, they still have a lot more work to do, and there's a long way to go. But I do think that the voters in this particular district, it's a very diverse district, are concerned, are interested in someone who's going to go to Congress, who's going to fight for them and fight the Trump administration and the policies that are coming forth from that administration. But they're also concerned about the values of this party, the Democratic Party, and the people that it represents. And these issues, though they're not national issues, they're very, very local and bread and butter issues. And I think Ayanna Pressley and Michael Capuano are very, very conscious of the fact that they are still rooted in this district. Both are from, he's from Somerville, she's from Dorchester, hard scrabble neighborhoods. These are issues that mean well and serve well for the people who live there. They're social justice issues, and they're about the quality of life. And I think they're very cognizant of those. And those are indeed accomplishments, even though there's still a lot more that needs to be done.
Okay, Megan Irons is the Boston Globe social justice and race reporter. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Stay with us. Coming up, why a Massachusetts delegation is traveling to Honduras and El Salvador. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. A Massachusetts delegation is traveling in Central America for what they're calling a fact-finding mission about how poverty and crime are affecting people there. Massachusetts Congressman Jim McGovern and Somerville Mayor Joe Curtatone are visiting Honduras and El Salvador on this trip. Tagging along is WBUR's own Shannon Dooling. She joins us now from Honduras. Shannon, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks, Deborah.
So you've just arrived at what's considered one of the most dangerous airports in the world. Lucky you. What's it like there?
Yeah, so I was warned about flying into Tegucigalpa, which is the capital city of Honduras, and the warnings were valid. I mean, it's a little bit of a thrill ride. You have these sort of unexpected drastic turns and dips in elevation and whatnot. I mean, but really our pilot just sort of masterfully navigated around the mountains and the hillsides. And this airport is really just a small runway that's situated on this plateau. So I can certainly understand why it's listed as one of the most dangerous airports to fly in and out of. But we made it safely. We headed straight to, get right into the day's schedule. And the first meeting was here at the hotel that we're staying at in Tegucigalpa. And it was with a number of Honduran human rights activists and individuals, individuals and family members who've been affected by the widespread violence here.
Right. And as we said at the beginning, you're with Massachusetts Congressman Jim McGovern and Somerville Mayor Joe Curtatone. And here's what Congressman McGovern said about the trip with a Spanish translator in the background.
And look, what we're interested in is the truth.
Nos interesa la verdad.
Yeah, and we're not going to get the truth from the president of Honduras.
No vamos a oír la verdad del presidente de Honduras.
We're not going to get it from the government of Honduras.
Tampoco del gobierno de Honduras.
We're not going to get the truth from the U.S. embassy.
Ni de la embajada de los Estados Unidos.
And we're certainly not going to get the truth from the Trump State Department.
So, Shannon Dooling, what truth is Congressman McGovern looking for on this trip, would you say?
Well, I mean, the truth he's speaking about there is really the truth about how people live day to day here in Honduras, what life is like every day here. And, this country has one of the highest homicide rates in the world. It has one of the highest femicide rates. That's, targeted violence against women. It has one of the highest femicide rates in the world. It's got one of the highest poverty rates in the world. And I think the congressman is trying to understand how those factors all combine to affect migration to the U.S. Yeah, what choices are people making here and why? And how does that impact immigration patterns? And, what do Hondurans living in the U.S. Now have to come back home to if they're deported back to Honduras? And I think he's also looking to hear from people about what role Hondurans see the U.S. playing in mitigating violence and, some of the allegations about government corruption here in Honduras. So it's a lot of different things that they're keeping their ears open for.
And have you, Shannon, seen evidence of extreme poverty, of violence that would help you understand why folks come to the U.S., or have you spoken with folks who've directly experienced that?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I quite literally just finished interviewing a young father who is from a city called Olancho in Honduras, and he traveled back in May with his six-year-old son. They left, headed for the U.S.-Mexico border, and I asked him, why did you make that decision? That's obviously a dangerous journey. Why did you decide to bring your six-year-old son with you? And he said, there is no work here. I have no work. All I wanted to do is make it to the U.S., work for a year or so, and then come back and build a little house for my family. I mean, those are his words. He said that he usually survives, his three children, he said he usually survives off of about the equivalent of $20 a month. And that's very irregular income. And I should say that his six-year-old son is actually still in immigration detention in the United States. We'll have more about his story later on in the week. But so there are some really hard decisions that people are facing here in this country.
So at this point, how would you say local folks are reacting to this Massachusetts delegation?
Well, I think there's a combination of things. I think people are very excited to have a U.S. congressman here, to have a mayor of a American city here. And so the delegation is certainly being welcomed with open arms. And there is some hope the part of the advocates and the human rights advocates and the immigration advocates, that, you know, that they are being heard and that these stories will travel back to Massachusetts and to Washington with Congressman McGovern, and you know, that they're having a voice. I do think, however, that there is a healthy amount of skepticism as well, and that, you know, some people have sat around these tables before with U.S. congressmen and felt like they were sort of, you know, listened to and nothing changes. And so I think it's a combination of both, that the Congressman McGovern and Mayor Curcione are both, you know, here repeating this mantra that we are here to listen and learn and bring this back with us.
Well, I do have to say, you've been posting some incredible material on social media, great videos. Just briefly, Shannon, when you're driving around the country, which many of us will not get the opportunity to do, what does it look like? Mm-hmm. What does it feel like?
Well, it's interesting. It feels like at the same time you're in this sort of tropical, the paradise, really. I mean, it's beautiful. There are these vistas, these stunning vistas of these mountaintops with jagged mountains that sort of reach up into the clouds and this volcanic soil, this really rich soil, the colors of the flowers, of the tropical plants. I mean, it's very, very beautiful. But at the same time, you see extreme poverty. You really do. I mean, you see people that are, pushing carts of coffee and snacks along the side of the road, trying to make some money. You see groups of day laborers sort of gathered along the side of the streets, trying to get some work that day. The infrastructure is very, very shoddy. Lots of potholes to dodge. I think the best way to describe it is something that I've written for our website, is that there's this beauty, but it's really existing side by side to this extreme poverty. And so it can be kind of hard to reconcile at times.
WBUR immigration reporter Shannon Dooling, who's joining us live from Honduras. Shannon, thank you so much for the update. Stay safe.
You're welcome. Thank you.
To see more of Shannon's reporting, you can go to our website, WBUR.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Recreational marijuana stores were supposed to open in Massachusetts on July 1. Yep, here we are, more than a month later, and they're still not here. State regulators say they are working on approving licenses and certifying an independent testing lab for marijuana. Some potential retailers say they're facing roadblocks as cities and towns issued bans, moratoria, and zoning restrictions on recreational marijuana businesses. So we're asking today, why is this taking so long? And what are people doing in the meantime? Joining us to talk about this is WBUR State House reporter Steve Brown, who's been covering marijuana legalization. Hi there, Steve.
Yeah, hi, Deb.
Also with us in studio, Jim Smith. He's an attorney at Smith, Costello & Crawford, which represents about 24 cannabis businesses in Massachusetts, right?
Right. Good afternoon.
Okay, welcome. And listeners, we want to hear from you about this. Why do you think it's taking so long for the recreational marijuana industry in Massachusetts to take off? What do you think of these delays? Are you part of some of those working underground to try to get in on the green rush here? Are you a retailer or a cultivator? What are you doing to prepare? And if you were in charge, what would you do to move things along? You can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. And again, we're talking about the July 1st rollout of recreational marijuana in Massachusetts that has not yet happened, even though it's August 14th. So, Steve Brown, how come? Why has this not happened? Give us a brief recap.
Well, the July 1st date is kind of a figment of the imagination. It was in the law originally, but when the legislature redid the law last summer, that date actually disappeared. The law said that the commission can start issuing licenses on June 1st. But the July 1st thing, that was part of the original referendum. But that kind of disappeared. But people just hung on to that date for some reason, saying that's the date it should start. So if you want to say that the spirit of the law was that July 1st was supposed to be the start date, then they haven't met the spirit of the law. But legally, that July 1st didn't exist. The Cannabis Control Commission said, well, we're going to try to start, you know, issuing licenses around July 1st. And they've been doing that. Those are provisional licenses, however. Mm. They've issued so far 19. About 6 of them are retail businesses. Many of those are already operating in the medical marijuana industry.
And so they're trying to convert to recreational.
That's right.
But as it stands, as of right now, Steve, there is not one recreational marijuana shop in Massachusetts.
That is correct. As I say, those were provisional licenses. As of last week's Cannabis Control Commission meeting, I had asked the chairman if any of the businesses that had been given the provisional licenses have come back to say, okay, we're ready for the final license. What they have to do is they have to have the commission come in and do an inspection. There's a few other things. But it's basically up to the business to say, okay, we're ready. Give us our final license now. And nobody has come forward to say, yes, give us our final license.
Hmm. So Jim Smith, you're an attorney, as we said, that represents about 24 cannabis businesses. They want to do business in Massachusetts. So what are they saying about all this?
Well, Steve has it exactly right, Deborah, that people are trying hard to do this. But we should go back a little bit. It's not at really the CCC level, the Cannabis Control Commission level in most cases. You go way back to starting a business in Massachusetts. First of all, the initiative petition, both the medical in 2012 and the adult use in 2016, did not amend the zoning laws. Zoning is sacred in the Commonwealth. Mm. We have 351 separate jurisdictions. We have 351 different sets of rules and regulations. So while this is a legal product, it can be zoned in a way that makes it all but impossible, and in many cases that is exactly what has happened, all but impossible to open. Assuming you get a proper zone, which, by the way, will then lead you to the special permit process, which takes more and more time, so you're not even at the CCC yet, you've got to get a location in that zone if anything is available. Some communities have zoned as few as 3 or 4 properties in the entire community. That's all. And if there's nothing for sale or for rent in that spot, in those spaces, you can't open in that community. Mm. Assuming you find a location in the community, well, does it have a mortgage? Because the banks might not allow you to lease to a marijuana tenant for federal legal purposes. So now you might have a location. Then and only then you begin the process locally with the community hearings, with the local boards of selectmen, the city councils, the planning board, the ZBAs. All of this is going on right now, literally as we speak, all across the Commonwealth. But not a lot of these have gotten to the CCC yet. And once the commission gets this, they have a process, legitimately.
So this is just doing business in Massachusetts. It has nothing to do with the fact that it's marijuana.
Oh, I'm going to get to that.
I'm going to get to that point.
I can open a liquor store, a tobacco store. I can even open a gun store easier than I can open one of these. Hmm. And every single community we go into across the Commonwealth and all of us go into, a third, 40%, 50%, you know, percent hardcore opponents, oftentimes on these very boards you run into. There are people
in local
level.
We've got 189 communities.
351. Oh, I'm sorry, the ban.
That
yes.
have banned recreational marijuana.
And many that haven't banned it are all but impossible to enter because of the zoning requirements. You have to get the special permit. You have to get the board, an independently appointed board, to vote yes, oftentimes by a 2/3 vote. That's very, very hard to do. You have community meetings. Believe me, 10, 15, 20 loud folks show up, you're not going to win in that community, even though it's zoned in that community. So this is a long, slow slog. People are afraid of the unknown. They're fearing cannabis. They say, well, it's a gateway drug. You know, we don't want that in our community. I have told every one of them it's in your community. It's at the middle school. It's not that hard. And by the way, that product is not tested. We have no idea what's in it. Mm-hmm. This product that we're trying to cite in a community is a safe product, tested product.
Same debate that we heard in 2016.
It is not at all. It's very similar, and we're hearing it all across the Commonwealth.
Okay, I want to remind listeners, if you'd like to join in the conversation about this, what do you think about this rollout of recreational marijuana in Massachusetts? Are you trying or hoping that you'll be able to get in on this once it gets rolling? And why do you think there is such a delay? Call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. With me in the studio is Jim Smith. He's an attorney at Smith, Costello & Crawford. I also want to go now to to one of those local communities, a gentleman from Needham, Dan Matthews. He's chair of the Select Board in Needham. Hi, Dan. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you. How are you today?
I'm okay. Well, tell us what's happening in Needham in terms of recreational marijuana.
Well, Needham, each community is approaching this differently. In Needham, which is one of the towns which voted against recreational marijuana, even though we have medical marijuana in the town already, exercised its rights, our town meeting, under the law to ban retail marijuana for the time being. Mm. As I think we discussed at the time, there's interest here, and there are some towns. We're in an area where some of the towns around us have banned us, and some of the towns near us have it. So there will be marijuana here, and of course we already have the medical marijuana, as I said, and the personal use is unaffected. But I think the thinking of our town meeting members and the other civic leaders that were involved in this was, this is a new industry in Massachusetts representing a major change in public policy, and we are particularly looking to see what the experience of this is in Massachusetts. And our law is different than the ones that are put in place in other parts of the country, some the same and some things that are new. We want to avoid what we think some may encounter problems and unanticipated adverse consequences. We want to understand how the industry works and understand more about best practices. I would expect that the town will probably revisit this once this rollout has
And when proceeded. Do you think, Dan, when do you think that might be? I mean,
well,
that could take
that,
for, I mean, a long time, but right now you're not allowing it in. And, you know, we just heard from Jim, and he says, you know, someone probably in Needham, he didn't say Needham specifically, but in most communities could open, right, Jim Smith, a alcohol liquor store, sell tobacco. You could even sell guns easier than you can sell marijuana.
Well, we don't have any gun shops here, and we allowed our first package stores in 2011. So I think that we try to work within the state law. We try to do things that meet the needs of the community and respond to what people want. And there are people that are here that are both for and against.
Right.
But I think that once we've had a few years of experience, we'll get to see more about how we deal with the public safety, especially motor vehicle operation that's involved with this. We'll know more. At the time our town meeting voted, the state had not adopted its social consumption site rules. I don't know if that's happened yet. Those are basically the smoking bars.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to understand more about how different kinds of host community agreements are working to assure that the revenues that have been said are available to us are going to be, whether that will really be true, as well as dealing with issues of underage access.
Dan, I want to ask you something, and I also want to ask Jim Smith this, too, because we spoke earlier today with Keith Cooper, who's chief executive of the medical marijuana company Revolutionary Clinics, and that's a company that wants to expand into the recreational market from the medical market. And he talked about this slow rollout, and he said one of the results is a flourishing black market in the state. Let's listen.
The black market is thriving, which is a shame. Illegal delivery services are rampant out there publicly delivering illegal product. It really is a shame that it takes this long to legitimize the market, get the tax dollars flowing in the right direction.
So that, as we said, is Keith Cooper, chief executive of the medical marijuana company Revolutionary Clinics. I'm wondering, Dan Matthews, because
sure,
Jim brought this up, and he said, well, hold on, let me ask the question first. Jim had said earlier that what you do when you have this delay is not only what Keith is talking about, which is this black market, but you're also allowing sort of unregulated, untested product onto the street because of what folks are thinking about. How do you address that in Needham, which has a ban on this?
You get a lot of questions into one question.
There's
been a black market in marijuana in Massachusetts since before I was born.
Mm.
And one of the reasons that the voters decided to make the change that they did is because they want to bring this out into the open and tax and regulate and have and control it, as well as legitimize it and not and not have this part of the war on drugs. And we understand that. But it's a complicated matter, and it's complicated, and the rollout, I think, is complicated by several things. First, I think a lot of people kind of still have a bad memory of the collapse of the rollout of medical marijuana a few years ago. Our town worked through that, and we have it, but it was really about a four-year process. The process the state is using now is methodical. Our town has followed it, and we work within those guidelines, but for all the reasons you've said, that there's this time that's involved. And then there's a feature that the original referendum had a lot of detail in it that was written by the industry for its own benefit. The fact that the legislature and the opponents said, wait a minute, fine, the public voted to legitimize recreational marijuana, but they didn't authorize this, and this that are in the detail of the bill as initially reacted. That slowed this process down. But, you know, when you look at this as something that is a new industry that in any new industry takes some time to settle in and have some growing pains, you compare the kinds of things that we've had develop in Massachusetts, even take a look at how alcohol has been dealt with over the centuries here, that it's a careful process.
I get it, Dan. Dan, we got to get to our callers. So hold on. Stand by. Okay. I want to go to Jeff, who's calling from Peabody. Jeff, you're on the air. Hello, Jeff. Are you with us?
To bring up one of the points that your caller had made about marijuana being a gateway drug. Obviously, that's the first thing that any fearmongers will do as far as their, trying to fight back against any type of recreational marijuana sites to open. I mean, there's arguments, obviously, up and down about alcohol, alcohol, tobacco, even caffeine would be the gateway drug. Even if any of those arguments have any type of scientific validity to them, is a whole nother question. Mm-hmm. It's really frustrating from the standpoint of possible consumers to see these other drugs and other alcohol being readily sold and readily available anyway, everywhere, and the fact that they have such a strong standpoint and aren't open to new points of view on things such as cannabis and even the fact that it could help with some of the issues of heroin and other things that are really people taking and really suffering, and this could possibly help them. And I think any type of elected leaders in our state should really step up to the plate and say, like they've been doing. I'm just very frustrated the fact that there's 190, 189 towns that are fighting against this with the huge amount of tax revenue that's possibilities. And yes, other states out west are creating the road for us to follow. And if we're not following what they're doing, we're missing the boat. And the fact that there's so much strong voice opponents to this, they don't represent the vast majority of the electorate that says that this is a good thing and this should be happening. And the fact that those voices are the only ones that are controlling right now is extremely frustrating from at least the way that I see it. Mm-hmm. It's a good thing. And I think that it's going to change the way people do business and really take a hit out of the black market to get that stuff off the street that could potentially hurt people and to really regulate it and use it for a good purpose in Massachusetts for the tax money and help people.
All right, Jeff, thanks so much for bringing that perspective in. I think, Jim, you had actually mentioned the gateway drug argument has been an argument, but you dispute that.
Oh, absolutely. Dan Matthews did a very nice job, really, I think, of making the case of the issues we run into across the Commonwealth. Let's be cautious. Let's go slow. Let's be careful. Let's wait to see how it happens. Well, it's not going to happen. That's why we're here today. It hasn't happened in the Commonwealth. There's so few communities that are accessible to the industry. And yet this passed, 54% of the voters, every poll since then, Deborah, has indicated more support across the country, frankly, for adult use cannabis. We don't call it recreational. We don't call it recreational liquor. We call it adult use. Uh-huh. And by the way, for Dan's perspective, I will tell you that you can get into a liquor store under the age of 18. Just walk in. You cannot access any cannabis facility under the age of 21. Okay, can't even get in the door.
We have a big wig on the line who's going to join this conversation with us now. Steve Hoffman, chair of the state's Cannabis Control Commission. You are on the line with us, ready to answer all of these questions and explain to us why
Thank you, Deborah. Nice to talk to you.
Welcome. So it's been a month.
Thank you.
What's the major holdup in your mind?
I don't think there's a holdup. I think that the process is working the way it was intended to work. We've met all of our legislative mandates in terms of deadlines, and we have 19 provisional licenses that have been approved. We have a queue of others that are under review. So I think this process is rolling out on time, the way intended, the way it was intended by the legislature.
What about this sort of notion of the black market and maybe folks feeling that July 1 was the date, they're not seeing anything, and certainly we've heard stories, read stories, some of us maybe even attended events where this black market, this underground market, is active in Massachusetts. And there's no sort of established adult use marijuana sales facility in the state. What do you say about that, Steve?
Well, I say two things. One is I say that the black market has been around for a long time, and I clearly believe that one of the objectives of the legislation is to minimize or eliminate that, and I intend to see that happen under my tenure. But the other thing I'll say is that, again, we're rolling this out. We have met every legislative mandate, so we're rolling this industry out, and it will be a thriving industry. It will be accessible across the state, and it will substantially impact the black market, and it will be a safe product.
Now, last month when we spoke with you, you said that a lack of an independent testing lab was a real issue here. But one of the big labs that's been testing marijuana, Pro Verde in Milford, said that they haven't been given any guidance about testing and what they're supposed to be doing. So what's going on with the independent testing lab at this point?
I'm not sure. I won't speak for Pro Verde. We've talked to all the medical labs. We have two completed applications that are under review, and it is my expectation that at least one, if not both of them, will be reviewed by the commissioner in our next meeting a week from Thursday. We have two other applications, four in total, that are at least partially completed. So the lab application process is moving along, and as I said, I expect that we'll have one or two up for review next Thursday at our meeting. And since they are operating already, once we give them a provisional license, I think the turnaround to give them a final license, assuming they meet all the conditions of the provisional license, shouldn't be that long. So, I can't say we have labs in place, but I'm comfortable the process is working and that we will have labs up and running when we need them.
What about dealing with local communities? We heard from Dan Matthews, as you probably were listening in, from Needham. He's the chair of the select board in Needham, and, there's a lot of concern. He wants to see how it's rolling out in other places first.
Sure.
How are you dealing with the communities?
Well, the law is very clear about what the rights of the various cities and towns around the state are, and we are aggressively working with both individual communities as well as organizations like the Mass Municipal Association to make sure that all their questions are answered, that they understand the regulations. I think as somebody, one of the people you've had on already said, we have 351 cities and towns in the state, and they're all different. There are a number of them that are going aggressively after this industry. And so, I think it's going to take a while before it's going to be in every town and city in the state, and probably we'll never get to that point. So I suspect we'll have, a handful of communities that will launch stores initially, and over time, as people see that this is a safe industry, that this is a beneficial industry in terms of jobs, in terms of economic opportunities, in terms of tax revenues, more and more cities and towns will sign up. So, I'm confident in the long term that this process is going to work. I think that it will take a while for cities and towns like Needham to come on board, but I'm comfortable that the vast majority of them will. And I just wanted to, I was listening. One of the things that was said was there's something like 180 cities and towns that have bans. That is not correct. There are 40 plus cities and towns that have banned retail stores or other kinds of marijuana establishments. The remainder have moratoriums, and those moratoriums are planning tools that, for the most part, I think with only one or two exceptions, expire by the end of the year. So, I'm comfortable that most of the cities and towns that have moratoriums in place have them in place as legitimate planning tools, and as they expire, those cities and towns will come on board as well.
Okay, so I've got you on the line. I have to ask you this question. So when are we going to see the first store?
I have been asked that question. I don't know that if I quantify the number of times, but lots of times. And I there's no upside in answering with a specific date. What I believe is that late fall, early winter, we will see stores opening in the state. And that is based upon the fact that we have approved 7 retail provisional licenses. My expectation is that they will get back to us relatively soon, saying they've met the conditions of those provisional licenses. We'll go out and inspect, and we'll offer, you know, if they have met all those conditions, we will give them final licenses. So my expectation is late fall, early winter, and I have no reason to change that. I'm pretty confident with that forecast.
All right. Steve Hoffman, chair of the state's Cannabis Control Commission. Thanks again for being with us.
Sure, my pleasure.
Jim Smith, an attorney at Smith, Costello & Crawford, which represents 24 cannabis businesses in Massachusetts. I'd like to thank you for your time today as well.
Thank you, Deb.
Also with us was Steve Brown, a WBUR Statehouse reporter, Dan Matthews, chair of the Select Board in Needham. We'd like to thank them as well. That's our show for today, though. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.